Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and the Boys. I'm Steve Lerman. You can hear this program and many other wonderful programs if you're in the Sacramento area at 96.5 FM. Today's program starts out with the bee death crisis, and then we go on to, can a country change its economic system? Can a country switch between different models of capitalism? The Economist's Britain Politics correspondent Jeremy Cliff explores whether proposals put forth by some British politicians can transform the UK's economy into one more akin to that of Germany, Denmark, and Sweden. And then after that, the foundations of modern terrorism. Martin Miller talked about the foundations of modern terrorism with Peter Slein, and he starts with the French Revolution.
Almost a third of the country's honeybee colonies did not make it through the winter. That's according to a new survey of America's beekeepers. In fact, that's been the case almost every year for the past 6 years. Beekeepers say unless someone can help more bees survive, there won't be enough to pollinate America's apples, blueberries, and other treasured crops. NPR's Dan Charles reports.
The U.S. Department of Agriculture began this annual nationwide survey 6 years ago after beekeepers reported some new and frightening problems with their bees.
Well, we started out literally by phoning beekeepers.
That's Jeffrey Pettis, who's in charge of the USDA's Bee Research Laboratory in Beltsville, Maryland. Over the past 6 years, on average, 30% of all the honeybee colonies in the U.S. died off over the winter. The worst year was 5 years ago. Last year was the best. Just 22% of the colonies died.
Last year gave us some hope. Honeybees were doing better.
But this year, the death rate was up again, 31%. When the survey started, beekeepers talked a lot about colony collapse disorder, colonies that seemed pretty healthy but suddenly collapsed. The bees flew away and didn't come back. Beekeepers are not seeing that so much anymore, Petta says. They're mostly seeing colonies that just dwindle. As the crowd of bees gets smaller, it gets weaker.
They can't generate heat very well in the spring to rear brood. They can't also generate heat to fly.
Farmers who grow crops like almonds and blueberries and apples rely on commercial beekeepers to make sure their crops get pollinated. This year, Petta says, we came closer than ever before to a real crisis. The only thing that saved part of the almond crop in California was some lovely weather.
But we got incredibly good flight weather. So the bees, even those small colonies that we talked about earlier, the small colonies that can't fly very well in cool weather, they were able to fly because of good weather.
And the bees reached every tree. Pettis says beekeepers can really only afford to lose about 15% of their colonies each year. More than that, and they lose money. Some commercial beekeepers are still in business, he says, just because they love it.
I mean, it's just something that gets in your blood, so you don't want to give up. You know, okay, it's 30% loss this year. I'll do better next year. We're very much optimists.
Beekeepers have a whole list of reasons why so many colonies are dying. There's a nasty parasite called the varroa mite, which they can't get rid of. Also, bee-killing pesticides. And they say there are just fewer places in the country where a bee can find plenty of food, plenty of flowering plants that provide nectar and pollen. That was especially true this past year. The same drought that left Midwestern cornfields parched and wilting also dried up wildflowers and starved the bees. That was a natural disaster. But May Berenbaum, a professor of entomology at the University of Illinois, says most of the changes in the landscape are the result of people's decisions about what to do with their land.
I just wish there were more incentives for more people, not just farmers, to plant a more diversified landscape that provides nutritional resources for all kinds of pollinators.
So plant more flowers.
Plant more flowers and be a little more tolerant of the weeds in the garden.
What's more controversial is the role of pesticides. Some beekeepers and environmentalists are calling for tighter restrictions on the use of one particular class of pesticides called neonicotinoids. Europe is about to ban some uses of these pesticides, but U.S. farmers and pesticide companies are opposed to any such move here. And the Environmental Protection Agency says it's not yet convinced that this would help the bees very much. Dan Charles, NPR News.
It may mean little in the overall picture of bee health, but there are many backyards and rooftops around the U.S. with a hive or two, including here at NPR's new building in Washington, D.C. Our so-called green roof, covered with soil and plants, as of yesterday, houses two small wooden hives with over 20,000 bees. No honey yet, but the bees have inspired an unofficial Twitter feed, at NPR Bees.
Access Sacramento broadcasts great speeches and interviews every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m., or you can get the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
It's time for us to admit that we have a problem.
That's true, Mr. President. You know, denial is not just a river in Egypt.
No. You're thinking of the Amazon.
Just do what you have to do, sir.
Demand is up, supplies are down. What I want is light, crude and brown. I crave oil to get my kicks. Attack the rack to get my fix. I love oil, oh, every ounce. Nuclear, I can't pronounce. When my twins go out for fun, I say don't drive, take Air Force One. Oh, we can't conserve it, we are just way too spoiled. Oh yeah. Globe is heating up, you know it's starting to boil. Gonna have to face it, we're addicted to oil. I saw the signs, but I don't care. Ozone holes, polluted air. A hybrid car might save the day. Each time I look, I say no way, those cars look gay.
I can't be saved, 'cause fossil fuels are what I crave. Without gas, I fall apart. I need fuel to start my heart. Whoa, whoa.
We like to think that we're immune to the stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Many shortages, you know it, is just a bluff.
But gonna has to face it, U.S. can't get enough. Might as well face it, we're addicted to oil. Never can replace it, we're addicted to oil.
Might as well face it, we're addicted to oil.
Might as well face it, we're addicted to oil.
This week, Britain politics correspondent for The Economist, Jeremy Cliff, asks if it's possible for a country to change its economic model, or is it stuck with the one it's got?
It's a cold, crisp winter night in Berlin in 1989. Communism is crumbling before our very eyes. Germans from east and west are at the wall, looking forward to a new dawn. And who better to help them celebrate this new freedom, to remind them of all the good times to come, than the star of TV's Knight Rider, David Hasselhoff. Yes, the ideological battle between capitalism and communism was at an end. The world, it seemed, was finally coming to its senses and embracing free market American capitalism. Some were even calling it the end of history. But our story begins not long after, when David Soskis, a political economist from Oxford University, made his way to that same city to set up a new research institute.
This all started in the second half of the 1980s, when there was a major move among economists, say among the economic establishment, to push the idea that there is one unique best solution for the way in which advanced capitalism works, and that's basically the American way of flexible markets, very active stock exchange, and so on and so forth. So when I got the offer of setting up a mini-institute in Berlin, financed by the German government, to investigate how does capitalism work in Germany and how does it work comparatively in the UK and the US, I jumped at it, even though eyebrows were raised in Oxford by my economist colleagues at my moving into this, going native in some sense.
Along with his colleague Peter Hall, Professor Soskis came to a radical conclusion. The world, they argued, was not converging on the American economic model. In fact, capitalist economies were, if anything, diverging. This theory became known as varieties of capitalism. Many thousands of pages have been written on it, but it boils down to one simple distinction. The clue's in the name. Varieties of capitalism divides the developed economies into two main sorts: liberal, free-market Anglo-Saxon ones, like Britain and America, and collaborative corporatist ones, like Germany and Sweden.
I guess that while I was a fairly normal macroeconomist when I was teaching economics at Oxford, I was also extremely interested in how other countries actually worked, and it was very clear that in a lot of the things which we were talking about in terms of labour markets, that Germany worked really much better than we did. Labour markets and skills. There was very interesting work going on comparisons between Germany and the UK, showing that Germany is just vastly superior in, and that this accounted for a lot of differences in productivity and so on and so forth. So I think that got me really thinking that there's got to be these sort of deeper differences.
I'm Jeremy Cliff. I write for The Economist. And in this episode of Analysis, I'm going to explore varieties of capitalism. In particular, I want to answer one big question. Would it be possible for Britain to change from our Anglo-American model of capitalism to the Northern European one? Now is a good time to ask that question. As previous episodes of Analysis have shown, the idea of seeking inspiration from our more egalitarian neighbours is popular across the political spectrum. The varieties of capitalism school is particularly influential in today's Labour Party. Ed Miliband is close to its key thinkers. One of them, Stuart Wood, is one of his top advisers. The Labour leader's desire to make the British economy more cohesive and Germanic is no secret.
We need a new era of wealth creation in this country, but it will not happen with the old set of rules. We're competing not just with Germany and France, but with China, India and Brazil. Now, don't believe those who would tell you that the kind of economy we have now will help us compete in the world. We can't pay our way as a country unless we invent things, make things, and sell real services and products.
Yeah, or nine? Can we make Britain more like our northern European neighbours? I'm starting my investigation here in Britain and at Canary Wharf, with crowds of people hurrying to work around me in the huge skyscrapers. There's JP Morgan on my right, there's HSBC on my left. And it's places like this that people like Professor Soskies are getting at when they call Britain a liberal market economy. These aren't factories churning out stuff. These are fast-moving service industries, employing people with university qualifications. For these people, the rewards are great. What about those without a whizzy degree in computer science or mathematics? Well, not much. Maybe cleaning the offices around me or waiting tables at one of the wine bars opposite. It's why liberal market economies like ours tend to be quite unequal. They create lots of lovely jobs, lots of lousy jobs, but not many of the middle-income manufacturing jobs that are so plentiful in so-called coordinated market economies like Germany, Japan, Sweden, and Denmark. I'm standing in a cavernous warehouse that could very easily pass for the lair of a James Bond villain. There are pipes all over the place, barrels of chemicals, gadgets and gizmos whose function I have absolutely no understanding of. What I do know is that I'm at a chemicals company in Denmark called Harder Topso. This company is in the clean air business. They make catalysts which fit into things like power stations and cars to clean the air coming out of them. And it relies on the sort of high-end manufacturing skills that these economies are known for. It has, I'm told, a very flat hierarchy, so employees are very free to manage their own work. And they have a lot of say about how the companies run. There's even employee representatives on the company's board. It's in that respect very similar to a lot of other coordinated market economies, and really quite different from how a lot of British companies are run. So I've come here to speak to some of the staff and find out how it all works.
Well, when you hire an employee, you hire his or her arms and legs to do some work. And if you do a little better than that, you also they also bring their brain to work. So they are actually skilled at what they do. But if you take it one step further, you will also have their heart, their passion for the work. And I think that is very particular in Denmark.
Henrik Guldberg Pedersen is vice president of the company. He says that heavy investment in its workforce is the secret to its success.
The profit is a result of how we treat the people, how we can get the passion to work, how we can invest in that social capital, you could say, how we can lower the power distance so we can engage them in taking a little risk here, maybe take a chance here to improve, doing a little experiment with their machine to see, okay, if I try to do this, then I'll do it a little better. Instead of being based on fear and just managing by rules.
So you need to empower them to...
Not only just suggest, but also to do it.
So it sounds like the power in the company is quite flat.
It is. I think that there's a low power distance between the top management and the shop floor.
And when you need money for investment, whether in staff or in machinery, how do you raise that capital?
Actually, we have the money to finance our investments.
Is there no temptation to float on the stock market, get a big whack of capital and really go to town?
Not for me personally, because I think it allows us to work on a longer term, not necessarily just to work on the next quarter on the stock market, being very focused on the short term winnings. To being able to work long term definitely is better than just focusing on short term wins.
This sounds great, but a little suspicious. Perhaps he's just feeding me the company line. What about Jette Christiansen then? She's one of the factory workers who represents her fellow employees on the company's board. Surely she can tell me about the gritty battles between the blue-collar workers and their bosses.
My role on the board is that I have four or five meetings every year where they're discussing strategic things and the goals, and so we can have an influence on what's happened and should we use a lot of money or should we take care. And you have a big influence.
So it's not just a cosmetic?
No, it is not a cosmetic. Yeah.
How do you get elected to your job? Is there an election campaign?
Yes, it is.
A manifesto?
Yes, there's an election campaign. And
what were your campaign promises?
No, we have no promise because we promise that we will work for the best of the firm. Because if it's not good for the business, we can't do it.
I see. So what about the power structures? Because, I mean, when I think about management
yes.
and representatives, I think of an adversarial relationship, one against the other.
No, that's not them and our. It's we are together about this. Everyone is heard and everyone can say something, what you mean and what's the best for the company. And then the management will take discussion from that and do what's necessary.
What about the trade-offs that a company needs to make in difficult times, for example? Say, orders are down, there's a lot of spare capacity.
Yes.
How do you go about helping the company work out whether or not, for example, to cut people's pay or make people redundant? How do you help them make those choices?
I'm only thinking what's the best for the firm, because it could be I'm losing my best friend, maybe, but if it's best for the firm, we have to do it. I have to do that. That's my job.
It's as if their roles are reversed. Yetta, the representative of the workers, is worried about the bottom line, and her boss, Henrik, is going on about workers' rights. Strange. There are always exceptions to the rule, but this is broadly how the Danish economy works, and what makes it so appealing to British politicians. Can't we just be more like the Danes? So egalitarian, so trusting of each other, so long-termist. The problem is, there are two obstacles. I hit on the first one shortly after leaving the factory.
Well, I'm on the train now, on my way back from Hardo Topsø, and I've been thinking a bit about what it is that people like Henrik and Jette are telling us about how their economy works. And what's evident from what they say is that you can't have patient capital, long-term skills investment, and employees with a real sense of buy-in to their company without all those things reinforcing each other. You can't see them in isolation. And I think that begs the question, can we really try and emulate elements of this model without trying to import the whole thing? It's an intriguing question.
David Soskis's research in Berlin in the 1990s led him to a similar conclusion.
When we started to try and put together a model to see how the German system worked, it became very clear that everything depended on everything else. So the German economy had long-term finance, cooperative workforces, unions in the plant, a strong system of vocational training, so that everything, as it were, tied together. And when you looked at the British system, you saw that you have a completely different system where you have much greater focus on general education and general training. You have labour markets in which people move around a great deal. They spend much less time in the individual company. They need, therefore, general skills to be able to move around in the labour market. You then need, in this system, you need the opposite of long-term finance. You need to have a very sharp financial system which really punishes companies which aren't making profits. So the whole system works, as you were, in the opposite way around.
Now, bear with me on this, but I think it's a bit like a game of Monopoly. When you play Monopoly, you don't just collect a property here and a property there. You win by buying the whole of a certain colour and putting lots of houses and hotels on it. It's the same in varieties of capitalism. Just as the Yellows, Piccadilly, Coventry Street and Leicester Square are worth more than the sum of their parts, so too are the elements that make up a liberal market economy or a coordinated market economy. You really have to pick one and stick with it. For example, say we wanted to import the Danish system of long-term training investment by companies. David Soskis again.
The way the British system is set up is that companies have to be hugely responsive to fluctuations in markets. And companies are really responsive to thinking of labour as something which you may have to get rid of if the markets go in the wrong direction. So the first big problem is companies need to have a long-term perspective, which they don't have. Secondly, the company has to have some way of ensuring that if you do train these people, people don't leave. And these people will want to go elsewhere if they get better offers from elsewhere. But other companies can make good offers because they haven't paid for the training. So this problem of poaching is, I think, a really deeply endemic problem in liberal market economies. Thirdly, you have to persuade young people themselves to actually undertake the training. And here the issue for them is, what's the guarantee if I go through all this training? What's the guarantee that having an apprenticeship with whatever company it may be, you don't really know what you're buying? So that,
so safer to take a university degree?
Much safer.
Listen, young people, listen to me. Don't try to buy no home down in Washington, D.C., cause it's a bush for down. Ooh, it's a bush for town. I got a wish for blues on gonna spending years all around. Me and my sweet wife and Miss Barnacle run all over that town. Everywhere we go to people, they would turn us down. Lord, in a bush for town. Ooh, it's a bush for town. I got a wish for blues on gonna spending years all around. white folks in Washington, they know just how some colored man a nickel just to see him by Lord in a bush boy town. Ooh, it's a bush boy town. I got a bush boy blues on gonna spread the news all around. Sweet white Marty was standing up there. Heard a white man say, I don't want no Negroes up there. He was a bush boy man. Woo, living in a bush boy town. I got a bush boy blues, I'm gonna spread in his all around. This is the home of the brave, the land of the free. I don't want to be mistreated by no bush boys, the Lord in a bush boy town. A bush boy town. I got a bush boy blues. I'm gonna spread the news all around.
And now for something completely different.